Kelly's Westport Inn presents The Royalman Report with Casey Royalman.
Every new bride to the royals leaves a guy in tights coming after her going, "I love scotch."
Michael Engel.
I'm the co-host of that show. Kind of.
Jeff Herr.
Back to baseball here.
Chris Kamler.
So, Ned, tell me what you'd like to do right now.
Take off my pants.
You'd like to take off your pants?
Music by 49 Stones and Andre and the Giants. And now, the Royalman Report.
And welcome in for another Sunday night. This is the Royalman Report. We want to thank everybody who's watching live. I think we've got a pretty good show this week lined up. Very special guest. Hopefully you saw this on Kings of Kaufman, and we've got Willie Akins here in the studio, and we'll be talking to him a little bit later on.
You know, it's not every day you have somebody that's been in an actual World Series sitting on your couch in your basement. So,
not quite.
That's pretty
day,
cool.
No.
I don't even have a basement.
So. That's exactly what I was going for, Mike. Right. Nice job. You bet.
So that's really exciting. Troy is in Denver visiting family, so he has to miss out.
Let's see here.
Best thoughts out to him. He's at the Fortress of Solitude or something like that. I'm joined, as always, by Chris Kamler.
Hello.
Who's running the board. And Jeff Herr.
Hello.
Fresh off of their groundbreaking interview with Kent Babb of the Kansas City Star.
Yeah, that was fun.
Absolutely.
Thank you to Kent for putting up with our crap. So that
Indeed.
Was really nice.
Thank
of
you very much to Kent. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was good stuff. You guys did a good job while I was out on assignment.
While you were going big time over there for 810 Radio.
Yeah,
with
man.
A fantastic
that.
Spot, man. That was great.
Good for you.
Okay, well, I went on 810 Radio, talked to Joel Goldberg and Jeff Montgomery, and I don't know. Go to 810 Radio and listen to it.
I was just going to say, you can actually listen to that out on 810's website. They have the podcast of it. So it was a good spot, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah, and... I guess we may as well start with that. The whole, you know, notice that Billy Butler is not going to be traded.
Nope.
Contrary to some reports on the internet.
Wouldn't that be funny if, like, the next day he actually was traded?
You know, I when I was feeding this guy this, like, made-up trade rumor, it wasn't too far off. Like, I made it as much as, like, I could see that happening. But the Royals aren't interested in trading Billy Butler, so I think we're safe.
I think that was what made it successful, is that you could say, someone could look at that and say, yeah, the Royals could trade Billy Butler, so I think that's what made that guy run with it.
I think there's a lot of things that made the guy run with it. So if you haven't been to Kings of Kaufman, the big article of the week is called Check Your Sources. It's about some of these guys who are pretending to be inside news kind of guys and inside baseball, saying that they have front office sources, and I think they're just guys making stuff up and reading headlines and being irresponsible from a journalistic standpoint. So I was just trying to...
You showed them Michael Engel, Internet Police.
I showed the one guy, so which I haven't heard much from that guy. And
I'll
the
bet
other,
not.
Scott Swaim, is not doing anything either, so... Hopefully, you know, people will take a second look at a trade rumor and maybe do some digging rather than taking things always at face value unless it's from, you know, Bob Dutton or,
right,
you know, some of those guys who are, you know, well-known, well-sourced, and reputable sources. So that was the big thing. Went on 810. Got a little mention from Kevin Goldstein, which got us some really good traffic.
Yeah, you want to hear it? Here's what it sounds like.
Yep.
The Washington rumor, and there was a lot of consternation over the Twitter handle formerly known as Scott Swaim, whose last tweet was "Nationals execs are livid, goodbye Twitter," and he's not the only one. You know, there was a really interesting article yesterday or the day before by Kings of Kaufman with a guy who basically almost kind of became a source for one of these people who pretends to be an insider. And got him to tweet a rumor that he just made up. Do you find that there are, in today's world, that there are kind of more of these people than ever who are kind of trying to skip a step and pretending to be that guy?
So that's the segment.
Whoa, hey, there we go. Hey, how you doing?
Echoes.
Yeah, well.
Awesome. Well, we are the Echo Network.
Right.
So.
Indeed.
Anyway, so that's kind of the big deal for that. But some other news this week in the AL Central, especially Prince Fielder signed with the Detroit Tigers, 9 years, $200-some million. Just incredible money, big contract. I think he was either looking for like a 3-year deal that he could get some money and maybe opt out, and then or a huge contract, which he got the huge contract. So good for him, maybe bad for the Royals. The Tigers were already favored, and there's been a lot written about what it means for the Royals in the AL Central this year and their chances at contention. So I think it's one of those things we'll have to see how it plays out. I don't know that it's going to change too much, but he's going to be around for, you know, 9 years. So what do you guys think about?
9 years is a long time, man.
It's a long time. He's 27 now. His dad, and you'll hear this later on in the segment that we did with one of the writers on Kings of Kauffman, that Prince Fielder is 27. Cecil Fielder kind of started going off the, he started breaking down about year age 32. So we'll see if that body type kind of holds up in the same kind of pattern.
Unfortunately, the being if he were to follow that trend and to go kind of take his downfall, if you will, at age 32, that's kind of the end of this window, if you will, for the Royals players, where Hosmer, Moustakas, all those guys are going to start becoming free agents.
Hey,
so that's the unfortunate reality.
I have
that,
a question. This idea, this phrase body type,
yeah.
Okay, when I was little, kids just called me fat. So I actually wish people would have just said I have a body type issue instead of you just, hey, fatso.
Well,
that's just me.
I can't change the past.
Suddenly, life lessons from
suddenly Willie Akins is kind of rethinking coming down to the basement. But anyway,
that's the other kind of the big headline. We'll see how that plays out. You never know. I mean, there's no guarantee that changing leagues is going to be anything that, you know, he's not necessarily going to continue to hit 40 homers all the time. It's probably a good bet because he's got insane power, but you never know. Sometimes people change leagues and it happens. Look at Adam Dunn. He signed a pretty big deal and had an awful season last year. So no guarantees. The other big deal is the Royals invited 16 players to spring training. Some of the names on there, Mike Montgomery, which is everybody I think wants to see him. Chris Dwyer is a guy. The other really intriguing name is Will Myers, who's getting his first invite to spring training with the big league club. So hopefully he can do well. I don't think he's going to see the majors this year, but...
And did I see Jake Odorizzi's name on that list too? Was he invited up there?
Yes. The full list, Mike Montgomery, Chris Dwyer, Jake Odorizzi, Will Smith, Francis Lee Bueno, Tommy Hottovy,
friend of the program, yeah.
Indeed.
Zach Minor, some catchers, Cody Clark, Max Ramirez, and Julio Rodriguez. Julio Rodriguez was in the Wilson Bedemit trade, I think. And then outfielders Will Myers, Greg Golson, who was a minor league signee, and Paulo Orlando. And then the infielders are Tony Abreu, Irving Falu, and Kevin Kuzmanov. So some guys who might make the club. But I think mostly, a lot of times, they want him up there to just get a look at him. Eric Hosmer was invited up last year, and I think he played in the first week of games, and then they had him back into the minor league camp because they didn't expect to break camp with him. So, but it's going to be interesting to see how Will Myers kind of fares against a week of major league pitching and spring training and how he approaches that. So,
I think from that list, Will Myers, Mike Montgomery, ones to watch as far as, you know, could Mike Montgomery make the team out of spring training and make an impact? And then could Will Myers kind of show what Hosmer did last year, a little bit of looking like one of the better players out there, minor league or major league players, and kind of maybe be an indicator of what his future could be at the major league level? I think those are the two you want. I mean, kind of stating the obvious here, but those are the two that are going to be the most fun to watch in that list.
Will Smith is kind of a sleeper, too. I've always kind of liked Will Smith ever since we got him because he just doesn't walk people.
He's been consistent.
Yeah, and I think anytime you get there, and he's 6'5", he's always been kind of healthy. You know, you get those kind of guys, left-handed pitcher also, you know, that's going to help give him a little extra shot. But the major league level, they're kind of we kind of know who's going to be there already. So I think it's just kind of a matter of a few spots here or there. So that's the big news of the week. Still kind of a quiet off season. We're still waiting for spring training, which is going to be in a couple weeks. that's really all that's going on in the Royals world. I wish there was a lot more interesting things. I wish we had an Alex Gordon extension to talk about. I wish, you know, we had a number one starter to talk about. I wish Roy Oswalt was signing with us for $4 or $5 million, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. So, stuff to think about. I think we'll go ahead and probably go to break because we want to talk to Willie Akins for the majority of this time.
You got it.
All right. So we'll be back on the other side.
All right, we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
This guy came into the bar the other day and was telling
me the big bad interview.
They had friends in town and went down to that fancy bar district downtown.
Yeah,
they went to one of those swanky no ball cap bars.
Well, that's good. Playing your video game over there.
Imported beers wasn't even one of those microbrew deals. This bartender rang up the tab and he wanted $27 for 3 dadgum beers. $27 for some beers. That isn't right. That isn't fair. So he took him down to see us. We got them some nice big beers for half that price. Even had one of the ladies find a fella there. Got him some pizza. Listen, don't fall victim to those overpriced, no ball cap bars down there. You might as well take your money and throw it in the trash. Kelly's Westport, it's the place where you buy beer. Kelly's Westport Inn, tell them the Royal Man Report sent you.
Hey, welcome back to the Royal Man Report. My name is Chris Candler, and we are super, super, super excited to be joined here on the Royal Man Report by the one, the only Willie Akins. Willie, how you doing, man?
I feel a little bad today.
You know, not feeling too good?
My head is spinning, vertigo, and it's just something that happened, and I have no reason, no why.
We usually most of the people we interview on this show end up feeling sick at some point in time, so that's totally normal. So don't worry about that at all. one of the reasons I was super excited to have you on the show is to hear kind of your story. Tell me a little bit about how you became a major leaguer. How you became, you know, where you grew up and how you made it to the major leagues.
Well, first of all, I want to give honor and praise to my Lord God, Jehovah, to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And I truly believe that I was highly favored by the Lord throughout my life. And, you know, in order to become a professional baseball player, you have to have skills. You have to have the talent. But I started playing baseball when I was small, little league, high school, went to college. And while I was in college, I got drafted. And a lot of things that happened in my life, you know, I believe it was just destiny because the year I got drafted, I was playing for a scout up in Baltimore. And the school I was going to dropped the baseball team. And the scout ended up drafting me. So, you know, it was just like I was in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. And you came up were you drafted by the Royals?
California Angels.
And you actually played a couple of years with the Angels. Is that true?
Right.
And so you came over the Royals in what year?
1980.
You came over in 1980. Tell me a little bit about that year. That was a pretty amazing year, not only for you, but for actually the entire team.
I signed with the Angels in 75. I was in the minor leagues for like 3.5 years. 1978, they signed Raw Carew, 7-time American League batting champion. And he was playing the same position I was playing. Make a long story short, I made the team in 79. After a month into the baseball season, I was sitting on the bench. And there was a ground ball hit to third base. Bad throw to first. Rod had to come off the bag and tag the runner. And he ended up breaking his hand. Next day, the manager, Jim Fregosi, called me inside of his office, and he said, Willie, you are my first baseman. And so once again, right spot at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I ended up getting a chance to play. I ended up having a pretty good season. I only had 379 at bats. I had 21 home runs, and I drove in 81 runs. So I became trade bait, mainly because they still had Raw playing first base, and I was traded to the traded to the Royals in 1980. Matter of fact, the Angels won. We was in the playoffs, lost to the Baltimore Orioles, going to the World Series, get traded to the Kansas City Royals, come over here and have a all-star lineup playing for the Royals too. George Brett, Amos Otis, Hal McCray, Frank White, all those good guys. So as soon as I got here, you know, those guys, they welcomed me in just like I had been playing here for a long time. And also got involved with a little cocaine at the time. You know, I was a social user at the time. We went on and swept the Yankees in the 1980 playoffs and went to the World Series. And everybody know, you know, my whole baseball career basically is based on the 1980 World Series, because I became the first player in over 100 years of baseball history to have two home runs in two different games.
And that record stood until it was this year. It was this year.
2009.
Oh, 2009.
Chase Utley.
Chase Utley, right.
I believe.
The Phillies. He tied it.
That was a great story at the banquet I saw you speak at, because the MC was, yeah, Will, you know, Willie Akins is back there, and he's in. And he said, yeah, didn't you hit a couple home runs in the World Series? I hit four. Two in two games. So you kind of put that guy in his place. That was pretty good. Go ahead.
Just what's that like when you – baseball is so different from the other major sports just because it's got such a long history and so many records that mean so much. I mean, when you can accomplish something like that, you know, what does that mean? What does that feel like to be able to do something and have that – in your history?
Well, it was a great feeling. In order to do something like that, you know, all the great players that have played the game, Willie Mays, my namesake, Reggie Jackson, all those guys that played in the World Series. Reggie hit three home runs in one game, and he had one home run in another game. But to become the first player to have multiple home run games, you know, that's a tremendous feeling for me. And it always be in the record books as I was the first player to ever do that.
And you had the game winning hit in game three too. So in the bottom of the 10th. So,
but the
good World Series.
Yeah, not bad. The undercurrent, at least according to some of the articles that I read, was that you were using cocaine this entire time. You in the World Series, you reported that you were using cocaine during that World Series, right?
The first game of the World Series was my birthday. I hit the two home runs. And one of my homeboys came up from Detroit, Michigan. And I told him to bring some coke along, and he did. So the first two games in Philly, we partied after the game. When we came back to Kansas City, about five or six of my homeboys from South Carolina, they drove up, and they also brought some coke. And the first game in Kansas City was the first time my mom had ever seen me play on a baseball field. You know, she never saw me play in high school. Wow. She never went to any of my events when I was a little leaguer. And matter of fact, she never came to any events at all. You know, I'm not trying to talk bad about her or anything else like that. It's just that's my life. That's what happened to me. And one of my message to the kids is that, you know, if you grew up in a home like that and you don't have anybody coming to your events watching over you, you know, you always have your teachers, your coaches, people that can be your mentors to you. And I was very successful becoming a professional baseball player because I had those people behind me. But to get back to the cocaine thing, yes, I used cocaine after every baseball game of the 1980 World Series.
What and within a couple of years, you were off the Royals, and within a couple of years after that, you were completely out of baseball. I don't really know a really good question other than to say, how does that happen?
Well, one thing that happened when I was playing for the Royals is that – When Dick Howser became manager, he began to platoon me. I was a left-hand hitter, and he stopped playing me against left-handed pitchers because I really had a bad average against them. And I didn't like that. And at the time, I was using cocaine. And drugs, you know, they alter your moves, and they changed my attitude. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a established big league baseball player at the time. And my thinking was this, that I wasn't going to let Dick Howser do me any kind of way, and I was going to do what I wanted to do. Which, you know, later on, it hurt me. I started coming to the ballpark late. If I wasn't playing, I wouldn't go out and take infield, batting practice. And I had an incident with him in Chicago. Ended up staying up all night. I missed the bus. Stopped by Kentucky Fried Chicken going to the ballpark. When I got to the ballpark, nobody was inside of the clubhouse. And the hitting coach, Rocky Colavito, came up to me. He said, "Willie, Dick, he wants to see you inside of his office." And I said, "Rocky, you tell Dick I don't want to have anything to say to him." So he go tell Dick. Dick come to the door. He said, Mick is my nickname. Come in here. I want to talk to you." And I just hollered out and said, "Dick, I don't want to talk to you. I don't have anything to say to you." So Dick said, That's going to cost you $100. And I said, "Well, I'll just win it back in the poker game." We used to play cards and gambling and stuff like that. But once again, to make a long story short, after I was traded to the Blue Jays, and after I was convicted in 1983 of the drug crime, I spent 81 days in prison. I had two strikes against me. One was I had been incarcerated, and it got around the league that I was a troublemaker. Mm-hmm. So when I went to the Blue Jays and I struggled in 84 and 85, nobody then wanted to give me a chance again. And after 85, I just couldn't find a baseball job here in the United States.
Now, in the early 80s in baseball, much like the late 90s in baseball when there was the culture of steroids and kind of there was a culture of cocaine use and drug use and in the early 80s. I know Vita Blue was also associated with a lot of that stuff. Did you find being on drugs and being a Major League Baseball that was just a normal thing because there were other people doing it, or were you, was that just kind of your lone deal?
I wouldn't say it was normal because most players, they wasn't doing cocaine. But we had met a guy here in Kansas City, and he was a baseball fan, and I got introduced to him through one of my teammates. And we just started going over to this guy's house, and it became a regular thing for us. And we had about six players on our team that used to go over to this guy's house and just socialize, sit down, snort cocaine, and drink. Mm-hmm. And he would follow us around on road trips and stuff like that. And when other players came into town on other teams, if they did drugs, you know, we got together and turned them on. And when we went to other towns, we knew players on other teams that was doing the same thing. So 1990s, 2000, whatever was the steroid era. In the 80s, you know, it was the cocaine era.
Mm-hmm.
And was that something where was it kind of baseball that you didn't really get into the drugs and the cocaine until you know, you kind of hit the major leagues, or did it start before? Where all did that start?
My first time ever doing any cocaine was in 1979 when I was a member for the California Angels. We was playing in Minnesota, and I was just walking down the hallway of the hotel and just happened to go inside of the hotel room of two of my teammates. And they had some white powder on the table there. And I asked them, I said, "What's up?" And they said, "Well, would you like to try some?" So I took a line. You know, at the time when I snorted it, I didn't really think anything of it. And after that, I really didn't get into any cocaine until I was traded to the Kansas City Royals. And all through my years of growing up in South Carolina, you know, I might have smoked a little pot once in a while, had a couple of beers, but drugs at that time, it wasn't a part of my lifestyle.
Tell me about your conversations with you and Kaufman during all this. I seem to recall, and I don't remember if I read this or just me being a huge Royals fan when I was a kid, there being something in the paper in 1983 when this conviction happened about you having a conversation with Ewing Kaufman that was a heated conversation or maybe a fatherly conversation with him. Am I remembering that correctly?
The only conversation I really remember having with Mr. Kaufman was back in 81, I think. I took the Royals to arbitration, and I beat them. Mm-hmm. And during spring training, Mr. Kaufman, he was down there, and he walked up to me, and he said, "Willie, I want to shake your hand." He said, you are the first player to beat us in arbitration. And he said, "If anybody deserve it, you do." When I was convicted in 1983, I never had a conversation with anybody associated with the Kansas City Royals. You know, it came out after I was convicted that they didn't really want to have a part of me and two other guys. One player, you know, he stayed on the team. He ended up donating, I think, $50,000. But I never had a chance to talk to Mr. Kaufman or John Schuerholz or Mr. Burke. I think Mr. Joe Burke, he was the general manager at the time. But no, that didn't happen at all.
And so you're traded to the Blue Jays, or were you released and re-signed by the Blue Jays, or did the Royals trade you, or was it free agent type thing? Or
I had checked myself inside of a rehab center. Mm-hmm. Right before I was convicted, or right before I pled guilty. And while I was at the rehab center, my baseball agent, Ron Shapiro, he came to visit me with Pat Gillick. And Pat Gillick was the general manager at the time for the Toronto Blue Jays. And Pat saw that I was, you know, in rehab, trying to straighten my life out. And he told me, he said, "Willie, I'm going to give you a second chance." This is after the Royals had traded me. I wasn't released. I got traded. I was traded for Jorge Arthur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He came over from the Blue Jays. But when I met Mr. Gillick at that time, you know, it just really inspired me, man, because somebody was willing to give me another chance in baseball. But not only that, in 1983, I had my best year in the major leagues. I hit .302, 23 home runs, and drove in 80-something runs. So, you know, it wasn't like the Blue Jays was really taking a chance on me. The Blue Jays was getting a player that could help them.
Mm-hmm.
So during this period, were there any players that knew of your drug use that took you aside and tried to steer you away from it? Or were people just kind of letting it go and just brushing it under the carpet?
There was one particular player on the Kansas City Royals. I'm not going to mention him or call his name or anything, mm-hmm. but you know he was a veteran, mm-hmm. and I was friends with him, and he took me to the side, and he told me, you know, "Willie, what you're doing could screw your life up." Not only that, in 1983, the FBI came to our ballpark. And we had a meeting, and during that meeting, this is the same time that we was being investigated, mm-hmm. in this drug sting in Kansas City. And this guy who was speaking, the FBI agent, he just used names in a conversation, saying that what if this player, and this player was caught up in a drug sting, what would happen to him? And to my amazement, this guy ended up calling out every guy's name that was going over to this guy's house who had the drugs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I recognized this, and I walked up to some of the other players and asked them if they recognized it, and they didn't. But because I was, you know, stuck on stupid, thinking that I could do anything that I wanted to do, I just ignored what he had told us. But I did take it to this one guy who had been talking to me about this. And at this particular time, you know, he just told me, he said, "Willie, they are watching you guys, and they know exactly what you guys are doing." But to make a long story short, If I had stopped doing what I was doing at that particular time, and if the other players had stopped doing what they were doing, we would have never got indicted.
Yeah. We're talking on the Royal Man Report with former Kansas City Royal, former California Angel, I've still never gotten used to the California Angel. I think my dad still calls it California, former Blue Jay, Willie Akins. And are you doing good? You need anything to drink? Water, soda pop, or anything?
Okay.
Yeah. So a couple years later, you're out of baseball. You're in a really bad place. And then several years after that, you're in jail. And you're in jail for a long, 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 long time. What changed your life, man?
After Mr. Gillick released me in 1985, he came to my hotel room. And when he released me, he offered me a job in the front office. And, you know, at the time I was 32 years old. Just a while ago, you guys were talking about Prince Fielder. And when there's, you know, Hoffman and all those guys, when they become free, so whatever, they'll be in their 30s. Well, I was in the prime of my life, and I told Mr. Gillick I still wanted to play. So I went to Mexico. In my first year in Mexico, I hit .454. 46.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good, yeah.
If you hit .450, that's like getting one out of two hits, yeah. 500, every two times at bats. I drove in 154 runs, and I still couldn't find a job in the United States. I was blackballed. That was in summer league. Then I went and played in Mazatlan down in Mexico in the winter league. And a Japanese team sent a representative down there, and I negotiated a contract with them for $300,000. And when it came time for me to go and get my working visa for Japan, I wasn't able to get it because of that misdemeanor conviction that I had on my record. So after that, I made a decision in my life that if I was going to play in the major leagues again, that I was going to do whatever I wanted to do. So I started back drinking. And when I started back drinking, it led me back to my drug of choice, which was cocaine. And I had been a snorter before. Now I become a smoker, and smoking is more intense than snorting. I played in Mexico 6 years. Four of those six years while I was down in Mexico, I was smoking cocaine and going out and playing baseball. I retired in 1991, and I had a little incident that happened in my house in Kansas City. I ended up pleading guilty to it, and the judge sentenced me to a year of probation. So when it came time for me to go back to Mexico, I asked the judge, and he said I couldn't go. And I really didn't care about going back playing baseball anymore because that pipe had become my baseball. Mm-hmm. You know, I became a recluse in my house for the next 2 years. And the Kansas City police started doing an investigation on me. Once again, I had an incident that happened in my house with females. This girl called the police and said that I was holding her girlfriend hostage and I was giving her drugs for sex. So they started watching me. And they finally sent this undercover officer in on me. And I ended up getting drugs for her. And they offered me a deal, 5 years to cooperate. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And 2 weeks before I went to trial, they offered me 9 years. I thought 9 years for what I had done was too much time. So I went to trial. And ended up getting 20 years.
Part of the reason that happened was because of something called mandatory sentencing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that also is later on jumped to the end of your sentence was the reason that it ended up being like 14 years instead of 20 years, because that was commuted. Part of that sentencing was commuted. It was what, unconstitutional or something.
They ruled it as unusual. So
unusual.
Well, yeah, like not usual.
Like cruel,
yeah.
Unusual punishment,
yeah,
type deal.
Yeah, it's not typical for what a similar crime would be at that time.
So you're in jail. You wake up in jail and all this happens and what turned your life around? What why are you sitting here, you know, praising Jehovah today and not doing drugs and you're still alive? How does that happen? What is that transformation?
Before I answer that, I would just like to answer the question about this mandatory minimum.
Yeah, thing. Yeah, absolutely. You bet.
Because I was charged with getting crack cocaine for her. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was a ratio of 100 to 1. For 1 gram of crack cocaine, a person would receive the same sentence of 100 grams of powder cocaine, which really, it doesn't make any sense, because if you got 100 grams of powder, you got 100 grams of crack. Crack comes from powder. But anyway, I got drugs for her 4 times, and they allowed me to break the law 4 times until they got it over 50 grams.
Mm-hmm.
50 grams was the beginning of the mandatory minimum 10-year sentence, which meant that if I was found guilty, I couldn't get less than 10 years. After I received my sentence of 20 years and 8 months, after being incarcerated for a couple of years, I rededicated my life to Jesus Christ. And I didn't rededicate my life to Jesus Christ because I was trying to make a change in my life. I rededicated my life to Jesus Christ because I had 20 years and 8 months, and I needed help of getting this 20 years and 8 months off of me. But what I found out is that after I started reading my Bible, hanging out with Christians, going to church, I started to change. The Bible says that either you're going to live a fleshly life or a spiritual life. In order to live a spiritual life, we have to feed our spirit. Before, I was all flesh. Now, I'm becoming spiritual. I stopped using drugs. I stopped smoking. I stopped cursing. I stopped gambling. Things that I used to do, I didn't do anymore. And I also went to 2 rehabilitation programs while I was incarcerated. I felt like I needed that. And while I was at these programs, I did inventories of my life, my lifestyle, things that I was doing. And this undercover officer that came to my house, I had a whole lot of anger inside of me against her, because I blamed her for me being incarcerated. But after doing the inventory of my life and accepting responsibility for what I had done, the fact of the matter is that if I hadn't been sitting in my house smoking that pipe and getting high, it didn't make any difference if this undercover officer came to my house and asked me for drugs anyway. I wouldn't have gotten drugs for her. So it was my fault. And when I stopped blaming her and started looking at things that I could control in my life, well, then I started to make changes in my life. Shoot forward 14 years. In 2007, the Sentencing Commission recommended to Congress that they amend the crack cocaine law. And this happened they made the recommendation in June, I think it was. Okay, if Congress didn't come back and say, no, it's not going to happen, by November 7th, this was going to become law. And when they amended the crack cocaine law, Congress didn't do anything about it. So November 7th, it became law. So when they amended the crack cocaine law, 19,000 people in prison became eligible for a 2-level reduction. It didn't change the ratio of 100 to 1. What it did, it was going to reduce the guidelines. I'll use my case as an example. I was sentenced on guideline level of the federal sentencing guideline. I was sentenced on level 34. So if my guideline got reduced by 2 levels, it would go down to a 32. Now, at the time, it wasn't retroactive. So they recommended that in March of next year, it become retroactive.
Mm-hmm.
It became retroactive. I became eligible for a reduction of my sentence, and I ended up getting like 60-something months. I only had 48 months left on my sentence. So after I became eligible for it, the prosecutor and my attorney agreed on the agreement. I signed it. I got released from prison.
So your attorney comes in and says, Willie, you're going home. You walk out of there, what's the first thing you go do?
Well, it didn't exactly happen like that.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen like that because I had another sentence on my sentence of 15 years for bribery of a public official. And so when she came back, she said, Willie, if you get your drug sentence reduced, you still have 15 years on this bribery charge. Mm-hmm. And since both of those fell up under different statutes, mm-hmm. I wasn't going to get any time off on the bribery. So I was going to end up in prison still anyway. But she did some research on that sentence I had a bribery, and it was an illegal sentence. The judge didn't sentence me to a guideline sentence. So I ended up getting my time released. The first thing I did when I got out of prison was that I went to Kentucky Fried Chicken and had me some chicken. Chicken is my favorite food.
Yeah.
And Kentucky Fried, right until today, I eat Kentucky Fried Chicken almost every single day, man. And, you know, I just had that urge of having some chicken. And that's the first thing I did.
That's great. That is awesome.
You might be getting a care package from Kentucky Fried Chicken here in the next few days, I guarantee you. That was what year that you got out?
June of 2008.
And so you'd been in prison 14 years. The internet, television, I mean, not television been around,
what you find on television.
What was the most amazing advancement, I guess? I mean, you know, all that stuff had, you've been aware of all that stuff, but what was the thing that kind of struck you as how the world has changed in 14 years?
Well, before I answer that question, I just want to make a point of and go back to when I accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Savior. And I asked God to bless me and help me get my sentence reduced. You know, it might not have happened when I had wanted it for it to happen, but if you look at those 14 years later, my original release date was May of 2012.
Mm.
After 18 years of being incarcerated, that was when I was supposed to have got out of prison. So that blessing that I was looking for happened in 2008. I got those 4 years knocked off my sentence. During my incarceration, I kept up with the outside world. I kept up with my family. I became a better father while I was incarcerated. Matter of fact, when I was on the streets, I didn't even know my girls. But I became a father while I was incarcerated. I read newspapers. I watched TV. I knew exactly what was going on the outside. And the year before I got released, I was taking a computer class, learning how to work on the computer and everything like that. So 14 years was a long time, but it wasn't like I was lost when I got out of prison. Yeah. Okay, I had never used a cell phone before, but I had used a computer. And you know, if you can read and write and you have a basic education, you can learn the ways of using a cell phone and a computer. So I wasn't really lost when I got out of prison.
Yeah. And so you get out of prison and you need a job. And so you start working construction right by the very stadium that you played in. What kind of thoughts were going through your head, while you were working that job?
When I got out of prison, I went to the halfway house. And one of the things that you have to do.
That's my dad walking in. So don't mind him. So.
One of the things that you have to do while you're at the halfway house is you have to find a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I get in contact with one of my old teammates, Hal McCray.
Mm-hmm.
And Hal McCray lived in Blue Springs, Missouri, while he was playing here in Kansas City. And while I was talking to Hal, he said, Willie, my next door neighbor owns a construction company in Kansas City. And he said, I've already talked to her. Here's her telephone number. I want you to give her a call, and she might give you a job. So that's how I ended up getting that job as a construction worker through one of my old teammates, Hal McCray. Then I contact one of my other teammates, George Brett. And George ended up inviting me to his son's middle school. And he asked me if I would come over and speak. And I had spoke while I was incarcerated. And part of my testimony is that I had a really bad studying problem coming up as a kid. And even when I was a professional baseball player, I had problems talking on radio and TV and stuff like that. So when George asked me this, you know, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to do it or not. But I said, let's go. And I went over there and I spoke and I talked to those kids for about 45 minutes. And after I finished, you know, George walked up to me and he said, Mick. Mick is my nickname. He said, where did that come from? And I said, what are you talking about? He said, you didn't stutter one time. He said, that's not the old Mick I used to know. And I said, well, thanks, George, but I'm blessed. And he said, I think young players in baseball need to hear this story. And you need to get back into baseball some kind of way. So George invited me to go over and meet the general manager for the Kansas City Royals, Dayton Moore. And I went over and I talked to Dayton. And, you know, I just told Dayton that I was looking to get back into baseball. And I used to go to the games and Dayton would ask me up to his suite and he started asking me questions about baseballs and stuff like that. And after a couple of years had passed, you know, I went over and I spoke to some of the players at the ballpark, and the Royals, they ended up hiring me. And to have spent 14 years in a prison and to go through what I had gone through, and I don't think it was just a coincidence that the Kansas City Royals hired me as a coach. You know, I think I have something to give as a coach, you know, teaching the players, hitting and stuff like that, but I can also be a mentor. And I have been a mentor to some of the baseball players. But for me, you know, it's just a tremendous blessing to be back in baseball again. That was one of my prayers while I was incarcerated. You know, I used to pray all the time that in some kind of way that God would allow me to get back into baseball. So I look at that as another blessing that God has bestowed upon my life.
So it's a weird, things work in mysterious ways, right?
They do.
You might be right back exactly where you should be all along. And, you know, maybe your testimony and maybe your story, maybe that stops some ball player from going down the same road. Or maybe it just gives you peace and closure to yourself and the serenity that you need. So that's outstanding. That's great.
Did you ever think you would actually get back into baseball? I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to be, you know, you're a hero in 1980, and then later you're working construction and trying to get back out there. Was it ever, like, what percent did you ever think in your head that you'd get back into the game?
Well, you know, I had never heard of it happening before. A player spending that amount of time incarcerated and coming back and working for a major league, you know, organization. I didn't expect it to happen so soon. I mean, it happened a couple of years after I had been out of prison. But, you know, when you have a spiritual life and when you have a higher power that is greater than yourself, well, then anything can happen in this world. And, you know, I don't contribute to anything that I've done, even though, you know, I was a baseball player. I had an outstanding career. I really believe that God touched some people's hearts. And that was the reason why I was hired back into the Kansas City Royals organization.
You talk about your life today, and you provided me with a couple of photographs. What do you think of when you look at this picture? This, for those of you on the audio podcast, this is a picture of Willie, and I assume that's your family. Is that correct?
That's it.
What? Tell me a couple sentences about what you think of when you see that picture.
Well, as I was speaking before, you know, I told you I became a father while I was incarcerated, and I wasn't a father on the streets. And when I went to prison, my daughters were like 5 and 6 years old. And when I got out, they were 19 and 20. So they had gone through their whole life without a father. They knew of me and they knew who I was, but they didn't really know me. And when I was a young kid, you know, I grew up like that. I grew up under a stepfather who was an alcoholic. My mom, alcoholic, in and out of the county jails. And I made a promise to myself that if I ever had any kids, I wouldn't allow my kids to go through the same situation that I went through. And I broke that promise. And it's pretty amazing for a person to grow up in a household like that and see that the devastating effects of alcohol and drugs, and this person go and do the same thing. And, you know, you really have to get to a point in your life that you have to break that streak. And, you know, I'm at that point in my life right now that what I do, I try to influence my daughters and the people that are surrounded by me. Another one of my prayers was that I would see a little baby grow up from being a baby to an adult. And I used to pray that God would allow me a chance to see that. And Sarah, who's my wife now, you know, she stuck behind me for 14 years of being incarcerated. And she ended up getting pregnant. And she had a little girl last January 3rd. And that was the blessing that, you know, we had asked God for. And a month after she had the baby, she had a stroke. And, you know, it's one of the most devastating things that has ever happened to me in my life. And, you know, it's really right that this point in my life is more devastating than being incarcerated for all those years, because I have to look at her like that every day. And she can walk. She can talk. She's not the same person physically, mentally, or emotionally. But she almost died. Her right arm is paralyzed, but she walks with a cane. And she gets depressed. And most days that go by, I cry each time I see her, because I just can't get used to seeing her like that. And I needed to help me with the baby. And one of my things is this, that I'm a Christian, and I haven't gone to God and asked God why did he allow this to happen in our lives. I know, you know, most people, when things are tragic or tragedy happen in our life, we always blame it on God, or a lot of people do. But when good things happen in our lives, me being a professional baseball player, you know, I never went to God and asked God, why me? Why you are allowing me to be a professional baseball player? Being a professional baseball player is something that most people don't get a chance to do. And, you know, I was one that was favored to be a ball player. So what I'm trying to say is that when things like this happen in our lives, we just have to accept the good with the bad and move on.
Well, that's so true. My my cousin's a quadriplegic, and he has been for 4 or 5 years now, three or four years, and he's gone through all of these emotions, and the whole family's gone through all these emotions. We don't know why that is the way it is, but it is for a reason. And you know, that picture of you with your little girl there, That's probably the reason, man. You're not going to get any answers from some, you know, schlub, you know, holding a microphone, I guarantee you. But I think at least, you know, maybe just telling that story and helping other folks, maybe that's the purpose, and maybe that's what the whole thing is for. And we wish you all the best of luck with everything. But my goodness, that's certainly something to be happy about right there in that little picture there. Mm-hmm.
Well, my mom, she passed away last year. She was 90 years old, and I never really had a great relationship with her. And, you know, my mom passed away, and my little baby is born into the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is the way life feels. You know, a person die, and one is born. And God has replaced my mom with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there by himself is a blessing. And, you know, I just wake up each day and just try to do the right thing, man, because tomorrow is never promised to us. So we just have to take care of our loved ones, support them, try to inspire people on things that have happened in our lives, try to influence them not to go down the road that we did and the negative consequences, but also try to influence them to become better people, become, as I am, a coach, a better baseball player, to make better choices in life. And I believe that's one reason why God put us here, to reach out and serve and help other people in this world.
Willie Aikens, ladies and gentlemen. There's probably not an easy transition from off of that, but man, Willie, thank you for making time tonight to come out
thank
and talk
so
to
much.
Us. I mean, we broadcast some of it live, and there's about 7 or 8 people watching this live, and they're very impressed with your story and with your ability to move forward. I guess the only question I would have to finish is, what's next for you, man? You're a coach for the Royals now. You're going down to spring training. You're leaving tomorrow, as a matter of fact, to go down to fantasy camp. What is it you want to see getting done with Willie Aikens for the next little while?
Well, for most people that watch the podcast and for the ones that are listening right now, I have a book that's coming out in April. It's supposed to come out April 1st. And it basically tells the rest of my story that I didn't have a chance to tell tonight. So for all the baseball fans, for all of the Willie Aikens fans, for the ones that are not even Willie Aikens fans, would like for you to go out and buy my book. Get a chance to hear the rest of my story. And from here on out, you know, I just want to serve. I want to be a servant. And the Bible says that we are all sinners and that we need a Savior. And to live my life in a way that could help somebody else get saved and for them to accept Jesus Christ as their personal Savior, that's my goal. Another goal is I'm a coach for the Kansas City Royals. And the Kansas City Royals last September had an outstanding month. And we have some really good players on that team. And I believe that the Kansas City Royals are going to play over 500 baseball this year. I really believe that. If we can get a couple of good starting pitchers, the offense is there. And I would advise the fans that, hey, what used to happen in the late 1970s and the early 80s, won the World Series in 85, get ready for some excitement back here in Kansas City, because the Kansas City Royals are getting ready to play some good baseball.
Okay, now see, I'm really glad you did that, because I didn't know how to be able to transition from jail and baby to the Royals. So thank you for helping me, because I was just gonna screw up all over it. But man, thank you so much for stopping by, and we'll absolutely keep in touch if that's all right, man. I'm very impressed with your story and the way you told it the other night, and tonight you did a fantastic job. Willie walked in and so, I thought I messed up that speech the other day. I was, well, there wasn't a dry eye in the house, man. Come on. But good luck to you. I mean, seriously, good luck to you. There's Royals Nation, that's what we call ourselves. We're all rooting for you, man. We really are. And best of luck to your wife, and I hope she's feeling better, and that little baby, and have some fun down there next week.
Well, Chris, I just want to thank you, Michael, and Jeff for having me as a guest on your show. I really enjoyed it, and I just hope the people out there got something from it.
Well, very cool. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
And welcome back. That was incredible.
So that happened.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah.
How do you follow that? I mean,
you don't. I'm just gonna shut down. That was amazing.
I'm really glad he mentioned something about the. I'm really glad he mentioned something about the current Royals, because I did not know how to transition.
Yeah.
The show to. So,
you've got a baby.
So, Eric Hosmer's swing. Your thoughts.
How about that?
He's a young kid, too. Yeah, I don't know. Thanks to Willie Akins for coming in. Incredible story. Very honest and sharing it with us. I mean, that's good radio.
Yeah, that was all right, and we really appreciate his time. And once I heard that story, I'm like, well, we gotta have that story told. And I mean, it's been told. There's a really good article if you guys are into reading stuff on Outside the Lines website on ESPN. Yeah. It's outstanding. It's well documented. And it's very, very good. But we're sponsored this week by Maggie Moose. You guys are familiar with that, right?
Maggie Moose. We talked about it last week, the gummy bears and the...
Go to Maggie Moo's, 72nd and...
Make a whole night of it. Go to Kelly's.
Go to Kelly's and then, we'll you know, the just Royal drive up and down. Yeah, that's a Royal Man special, all right. But they're helping us out the next few weeks. And so thank you, Maggie Moo's. And actually, we were going to go up there today, and we had a little sidebar that we had to go do, but... we were talking with him after the interview, and he was kind of telling us about his plans for spring training. And he's a coach. I mean, he's not just go up there and, you know, shake some hands and tell your story. No, he's up there coaching. Yeah. He's going to be an extended spring training coach. Absolutely. So he was talking to my dad about swing techniques and all that. And I was like, Dad, he's got to go. So
he's heading out there tomorrow, he said. So.
Yep.
He'll be tomorrow there for the Royals fantasy camp. And then he'll be back.
Who I believe we have a listener, Dave Darby, that'll be going out there.
Good luck out there, brother.
Tell him you heard him on the Royal Man Report. You liked the story because it was incredible.
Get us some interviews and we'll put them on.
Yep.
And the for anybody who's interested, we put the link in the chat room. The title of that book that Willie referenced is going to be It's Safe at Home by Gregory Jordan. So it's by Triumph Books. It's available on Amazon.com. I'm going to get it into my store, so that's my day job.
I'm going to buy it.
Yeah, I'll buy it.
I think I'm going to go for it. I'm going to make that purchase.
I buy baseball books all the time anyway. I might as well get a great story.
Well, and I can't think of a lot of good Royals reads. There's Denny Matthews has published a couple of books. And
Ryan LaFever had one a couple years ago.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't read it. I'm sorry, Ryan, if you're listening. She might be.
This just in, not appearing soon on the Royal Man Report. Ryan LaFever.
Probably true regardless. So,
you know. I feel like George Brett have a book? I don't know. I mean, I feel like he should.
He's got about nine.
Yeah.
I think I was walking through Brett's, my 9-year old's elementary school library, you know, that whole row of like biographies,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Brett.
I think there was a George Brett one in there. But so what else we got to talk about, boys? What else going on this week on the old website?
We got some new writers coming on to Kings of Kauffman. That's kind of the main thing. We're gearing up for spring training, so I think.
Oh, is that coming up? Is that next month?
Spring training.
Yeah. Is that?
It just happens to be next month.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
What a coincidence. That good you thing. Asked you if should it was start next month, and it actually
should,
is next month.
You should
month.
Start. Yeah. Gearing up for it.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, we could start talking about 2013 spring training if you want, but no, we're talking about next month.
God bless you guys.
Yep. So that's what's going on. I mean, I don't think the Royals are going to make any big signings or transactions, so it's pretty much just watching what happens in camp, going from there. You all right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Are you okay, buddy?
I was just...
Jeff got excited for a minute.
The cord was in the way. I was moving it.
I hate when that happens.
Yes. Apparently, that's very distracting for the cord to be in the way. So I'll make sure.
Apparently, for you.
All right.
We're all flustered, boys. We're not usually used to doing good work, and I think we did some good work there tonight.
Absolutely.
I think our best work was just staying out of the way.
Stay. That's what did I put in the notes? I said, "Stay the hell out of that boy's way."
So
I asked him before the interview. I said, "Will you want to just talk? Or you?" He said, no. I'd really ask. You know, if you could ask me some questions, and I said, "Okay, well."
Oh, and by the way,
I asked him like one question.
In case anybody's curious, so we didn't give him any sort of a feeder sheet. Like all those stats he was rattling off from every year of his career were right off the top of his head. We didn't tell him. We didn't show him the computer screen. They were on the dot, correct.
Rock solid.
I had the baseball reference page pulled up, and he nailed every one of them.
He got to him before we even had a chance.
Exactly.
To.
And he just.
introduced us once, and he remembered all our names. I mean, he's an impressive man.
I can't
that
do
is
that.
Absolutely, I can't do that either. He's an impressive man. That is absolutely for sure.
So next week we are not going to have a live show because we're going to be doing untoward things at Kelly's, very likely. We're going to have something that Troy's cooking up. I'm not sure what he's going to do. We're all supposed to write about our favorite day or, you know, what our favorite color is. I think we're going to record. And
I like clear. That's my favorite color.
Lilac, same as the bar that I like to go to. So
not surprising.
Eucalyptus leaves.
Not surprising. So that's all I know. What we talked about. Yeah, screw it. I'm playing the music.
Yeah, we're getting out of here.
We're
yeah.
done, boys. So for Michael Engel, for Jeff Herr, for the vacationing Troy Olson, I am Chris Kamler saying goodnight and go Royals.
Echo Network.